though. I mean, Hanford officials, as recently as a couple of months ago, denied that there were even exposures. You know, had much fanfare, press conference, and took me, you know, the reporters out on the Hanford site and said, we don't have any exposures out here. This is one of the healthiest workplaces in the nation and in the world. You know, Hanford officials have told me it's more dangerous to pump gas in your car than it is to work at the Hanford site. So Hanford is in a state of denial. They deny that anyone is hurt. They deny that these chemicals are dangerous. It goes beyond irritation of sinuses and nosebleeds and headaches and deeper into actual, you know, disabilities and bad health effects on people. But Hanford refuses to, you know, address that evidence and whatnot. So we are looking forward to an era when this is taken more seriously. Hanford stops referring to the chemicals as irritants and addressing them as very toxic chemicals. And some of these are. Some of these are dangerous in trillionths of a part per million, right? You know, molecules of this stuff, when breathed in, can cause a health hazard. And that is established medical fact. We just don't know who has breathed that in at Hanford and connected that to their health condition, because Hanford doesn't measure for those kind of things.
So a number of groups are going to have your own press conference tomorrow. Are you basically going to be saying what you said to me now?
Yes, we'll be announcing our own strategy. And we fully support what the Attorney General has done, and we'd like to see some other things happen. So we'll be announcing our own strategy tomorrow in conjunction with the Pipefitters Union, which is Local 598, and Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Hanford Challenge. All three of us will be having an announcement tomorrow to talk about what we feel are the things that need to happen to protect workers at the Hanford site.
Brittany Maynard, the young woman who chose to end her life in the state of Oregon via physician-assisted suicide, is under attack by the Vatican. The Vatican's top bioethics official lambasted her choice, calling it reprehensible. Maynard's mother, Debbie Ziegler, has issued a written response calling the Vatican's remarks more than a slap in the face. Ziegler called her daughter's choice to end her life a human rights issue. Her response was made through Compassion and Choices, an advocacy group that works on behalf of those considering physician-assisted suicide. More than 700 people have used Oregon's Right to Die law as of the beginning of this year. Only 6 of these people were younger than age 35.
Every day this week on the KBOO Evening News, we're presenting a segment of a series created by KBOO reporter Suzanne LeGrand about Portland's latest branding as a startup city for tech companies. Here's part 2 of the new tech boom in Portland on diversity in the tech industry.
Where do new ideas come from? A lot of people picture an individual genius, a Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, working alone in their garage to produce a revolutionary idea. At the TechFest Northwest Talent Fair, held this past August, I asked Melinda Conant, recruitment manager at Urban Airship, what she looks for in those hoping to work in technology.
So the two things that I use to often describe our company and the reason that I love working there, and the two things that I look for in people, is creative problem solving and collaboration.
Most work in technology is done in small groups, with the idea being that to problem solve, two heads are better than one, and a diversity of ideas creates better solutions. But this raises a question: who makes up these groups? According to a report put out this year by Level the Playing Field, African Americans make up 4% of the tech industry workforce, and Latinos make up 5%. In the same report, they also said that women make up 25% of the total workforce, with African American women being 3% and Latina women being 1%. In this respect, the stereotype of a computer nerd as someone white, male, in his 20s or 30s, and fairly well educated may not be that far from who actually makes up the tech industry currently. At this year's TechFest Northwest, one of the speakers was Mara Zapata, co-founder of Switchboard. She talked about the tech community being historically a kind of monoculture and about the need to create new, more inclusive models within the tech community. I asked her what she thought true diversity might look like in the tech industry.
A diversity of gender, obviously. It looks like a diversity of life experience. So, you know, I came from a very non-traditional background, and the people that I found to be really interested in tech are the ones that came from non-traditional tech backgrounds and bring a different, kind of a different ethos and perspective on technology. I think diversity looks like a difference of age. So so much of technology is built for the young, and what would it look like to start to build platforms and spaces that engage everyone in the community? So I think across any definition that, you know, you could possibly imagine, we need everyone's voice in technology.
I talked to Amy Haas, attendee at this year's TechFest Northwest Talent Fair. I asked her if she had experienced gender discrimination and what changes she had noticed since she started working in the tech industry.
Access to equipment has gotten much cheaper. So now, you know, almost anybody can get a hold of some, you know, for example, a smartphone or something and learn and get into it. So, yeah, there's still the digital divide, I guess you could say, but it's, I think, smaller, less of a problem.
The digital divide that Haas is referring to is unequal access to computer technology and the information it provides. Many people believe that the problem of unequal access to technology is decreasing, despite the fact that wealth inequality in the U.S. is on the rise. Similarly, while many people acknowledge that there is a problem of lack of diversity in the tech community, they believe that the problem is being addressed. There are, for example, many new organizations, such as Women Who Code, who are attempting to bring more women into the tech industry by teaching them how to program. Also, there are new programs being developed, such as Code Oregon. According to Clint Finley, in a recent article in Oregon Business Magazine, Treehouse has recently partnered with Work Systems. Also, there are new programs being developed, such as Code Oregon. According to Clint Finley, in a recent article in Oregon Business Magazine, Code Oregon will give 10,000 students the chance to take Treehouse's classes in computer coding for free. As of mid-August, over 5,000 students had already signed up. Diversity also includes diversity in values. Instead of developing more leaders, Mara Zapata argued in her talk that the tech community should instead recognize and value what she calls feeders, people within an organization who take care and nurture the people within it.
I'm asking you to find feeders. You cannot mistake them because it is the difference between a factory farm and a garden. Make feeders of your leaders. Give your feeders and your organizations and companies the opportunities to grow in the ranks so that they can lead your companies and be on this stage a year from now.
Matt Mansfield, former digital editor of National Geographic and a speaker at this year's TechFest Northwest, proposed a different solution.
I would hire people whose main job was to tell us that we were full of because I wanted them to look at stuff and say to us, that is not what we need to present to the public. We can do this better. And so I think, you know, as much as you need a collaboration group, you need people to also be radically frank with you.
As long as there's a lack of racial, gender, and age diversity in the tech industry, getting a true difference of opinion may be hard to come by. In the next part in this series on technology in Portland, I'll take a look at what's called disruptive technologies and how some people want to use technology as part of a movement for social change. This is Suzanne LeGrand reporting for KBOO Community Radio.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be cloudy with a high of 50 degrees and a low of 44. There's a 20% chance of rain, and winds will blow east by southeast at an average speed of 5 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln delivers the Gettysburg Address. In 1943, the Nazis massacred 6,000 Jews after their failed uprising at the Yanowska concentration camp in western Ukraine. And in 1998, President Bill Clinton was impeached by Congress for perjury. Clinton was accused of lying under oath in congressional testimony concerning an affair with aide Monica Lewinsky.
It is 5:20, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As an old popular song asks, what do you get if you work your fingers right down to the bone? Bony fingers. As housekeepers in the sprawling Marriott chain of hotels know, that's more than a cute lyric, it's the truth. These room attendants, as they're called, are paid barely $8 an hour to perform a very hard physical job, suffering the highest injury rate in the so-called hospitality industry. Some two-thirds of them have to take pain medication just to get through their day of heaving 100-pound mattresses, stooping to clean floors, and twisting to readjust furniture in 15 to 20 rooms per shift. Yet, Marriott's CEO publicly hails the very women he exploits as, quote, the heart of the house, saying his chain likes to express its appreciation to them with, quote, special recognition events during International Housekeepers Week. Yes, exploited room attendants are not rewarded with a living wage, but with a congratulatory week. How great is that? This year, Housekeeper Week came with a new tipping initiative, a scheme created by multimillionaire Maria Shriver, urging Marriott's customers, quote, to express their gratitude by leaving tips and notes of thanks for hotel room attendants. Shriver says she hopes the voluntary tips, quote, will make these women feel validated. Is that sweet or what? Does she at least urge that this tip be the standard 15 to 20% we give at restaurants? No, $1 to $5 per night stay is recommended. Let's see, at about $250 a day for a Marriott room, even $5 is a sad 2% expression of gratitude. As for customers leaving a little thank you note, imagine trying to buy a bologna sandwich with that. This is Jim Hightower saying, how about this? Instead of paying $9 million a year to Marriott's CEO, make him rely on customer tips and see how validated he feels.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
President Obama will announce his plan to reform the U.S. immigration system tomorrow. He will give a televised address and visit a Las Vegas high school to promote his plans to bypass Congress and make changes through executive order. The president posted a video message on the White House Facebook page telling viewers that Washington has allowed the problem to fester for too long. He said that he wants to use his lawful authority to do as much as possible while continuing to encourage Congress to make a bipartisan comprehensive bill to solve the entire problem. The GOP takeover during the midterm elections made it less likely that President Obama will be able to negotiate broad immigration reform. He said that this means that he will use the power of his office to push new measures attempting to protect some of the 11 million undocumented migrants living in the U.S. Republican leaders said that they strongly oppose Obama using his presidential power to force the issue. They warned that implementing executive authority would only make legislative reform more difficult.
On Tuesday night, the U.S. Senate failed to get the necessary 60 votes to pass the USA Freedom Act. The USA Freedom Act would have divested the NSA of most of the U.S. phone records database disclosed last year. The act aroused the criticism of many Senate Republicans, including Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, who warned of impending attacks from ISIS on the streets of New York if it had come to pass. The vote on the act comes in the wake of numerous revelations regarding domestic spying by Edward Snowden. But there's hope on the horizon for civil libertarians. The provision of the Patriot Act, which is cited by the government to justify bulk domestic phone records collection, known as Section 215, is set to expire in June. KBOO's Dan Richardson spoke with Mark Jaycox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation to learn more about the vote, as well as possible future developments related to domestic spying.
So I'm speaking with Mark Jaycox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And last night, the U.S. Senate failed to get the necessary 60 votes to pass the USA Freedom Act. I was wondering, what chance do civil liberties have of seeing the Senate pass the USA Freedom Act in the current legislative session?
Yeah, in the current legislative session, there is admittedly little chance. Just the way the calendar works and the timing of the Senate for the end of the session, we probably won't see the USA Freedom Act have another vote. Now, there is a possibility it could, but it's a slight possibility. It's very small. I think what we're looking forward to, and I think the next steps for surveillance reform, is going to be what a Republican Senate does and the debate that the Republican Senate will have.
And if the Section 215 of the Patriot Act is set to expire in June, is it really necessary to see the USA Freedom Act pass in some form?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is necessary because the Section 215 is part of three provisions that expire in June 2015. The USA Freedom Act does not just deal with Section 215. It stems the bulk collection, this mass collection of our calling records and other data, by reforming Section 215, but by also reforming other laws. Because Section 215 is not necessarily the only section or statute that the government is using for this mass spying or this mass collection of Americans' records. The USA Freedom Act narrowed down and made sure to constrict the government's ability by reforming not only Section 215, but also these other surveillance laws that were changed with the Patriot Act.
And will it take more revelations from whistleblowers on domestic and foreign spying, such as Edward Snowden, for example, to increase support for the legislation?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think right now Congress is grappling with Section 215. They understand Section 215. The American people understand Section 215 and what it's being used for. I think right now, more revelations and more information about the things that are still unknown, right, are helpful. We still don't know a tremendous amount about other programs that are potentially collecting other Americans' data or records. We know that through the revelations and through the both government declassified documents and documents from whistleblowers, that the government is collecting a tremendous amount of information of Americans. This includes anywhere from emails and phone calls to address books. What we don't know is that there are probably other programs collecting information. We just don't know what those exact programs are. So if anything, more revelations, more news, more descriptions of the unknown programs or of the unknown programs that are collecting Americans' data would be useful. Right now we have a pretty full record on Section 215 and what it's being used for, and there may be other uses that we don't know about. There are potential indications in government documents that they're using Section 215 to collect financial records and conducting very similar mass collection practices with financial records and similar to the calling records program. So, information about that is certainly useful and would be certainly useful. But, as of now, there is a tremendous amount of information on the issues that the USA Freedom Act touches. And it's a matter of convincing, just those two votes are convincing, a Republican Senate to act on this reform and to ensure that they are actually accomplishing what the American people want, which is time and time again on these polls, on polls that are released, Americans do not like the collection practices that have been revealed and are overwhelmingly for reforming them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Mark J. Cox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks again.
No problem. Thank you.
A federal judge struck down the ban on same-sex marriage in Montana yesterday. The order goes into effect immediately, meaning same-sex couples can apply for marriage licenses today. Last month, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. Montana is part of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but was the last state to lift the ban. Arizona, Alaska, and Wyoming lifted bans last month after the Ninth Court's decision. A Charleston County judge has also issued South Carolina's first same-sex marriage license, making it the 35th state to allow marriage equality.
NBC and Netflix have announced that they are shelving proposed projects involving comedian Bill Cosby. In recent weeks, Cosby's been accused of drugging and sexually assaulting women, adding to assault allegations by a total of 15 women made nearly a decade ago. In the past week, two women have alleged that Cosby raped them over a period spanning decades, a charge Cosby has steadfastly refused to comment on. NBC was reportedly working on developing a sitcom starring Cosby, while Netflix was producing a special program commemorating Cosby's 77th birthday. Neither NBC nor Netflix commented on the reasoning behind their decisions. In 2006, Cosby settled out of court with one of his accusers, who had filed a civil suit against him for an undisclosed sum.
As tensions mount in Ferguson, Missouri, many people believe that the only resolution in sight is a violent one. In his opinion editorial piece, Who Says Ferguson Can't End Well?, David Swanson addresses this sentiment and proposes that a peaceful protest and nonviolent civil disobedience may bring a renewed dialogue. News correspondent Riley Turner spoke more in depth with David about the current situation and how it may be resolved peacefully.
So you said that you had read a headline regarding Ferguson that states there is no way this could end well. Now, given the preemptive measures taken by the state and local government and the tension surrounding the grand jury's decision on whether to charge Darren Wilson, it's not hard to fall into that frame of mind. But if you could briefly explain to us why this mentality is so damaging to the current situation in Ferguson.
Well, I think it can potentially create a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's not just the local and the state governments, but the federal government as well. I have a friend, an activist, who's been contacted by the Homeland Security Department, which is very much concerned about what's going to happen in Ferguson, urging activists to be nonviolent. And my friend, of course, pointing out that it is more often than not the police provocateurs that are violent. The National Guard, of course, is ready and deployed. The Washington Post and the other newspapers are reporting as if the public, the silent majority in Ferguson, wants the National Guard armed and on the streets, where, to my knowledge, there's been no such vote or poll or indication. And so for the governor to declare a state of emergency and ready violence, and for the police in negotiations to refuse to say they won't use tear gas, they won't engage in mass arrests, and so forth, is asking for trouble. And they would tell you that they're simply rationally expecting trouble, but they're also potentially generating it, you know, directly in terms of infiltration and provocation among activist groups, but also just by putting out this mentality that's scaring everybody. It's causing, you know, gun sales to go through the roof in Ferguson. I think it's literally asking for trouble. And you have nonviolent organizers actively and publicly organizing for nonviolent civil disobedience, for protest, for exercise of First Amendment rights. And you have the police trained, conditioned by the federal government to treat exercise of First Amendment rights as sort of low-grade warfare, as potential almost terrorism, to treat the public as the enemy. And then, of course, they are armed with the weapons of war. And this is what started this madness, the oppression that leaves so many people so ill off in the midst of such wealth, and the militarization of the police, the training that tells the police the public is your enemy. You know, that's the root of the problem, and they're trying to solve it by exacerbating it.
While comparing Ferguson protesters to the textile workers' strike in 1919, you point out that this kind of intimidation and violence is not new and is not limited to Ferguson. My question for you is, what can we do when we aren't a part of the people specifically being targeted? In times of relative peace, are there behaviors we can adopt to help stop this sort of preemptive, intimidating violence from occurring?
Well, I think you're discussing this on a radio show is very helpful, and I think people from anywhere should be calling into radio shows in Missouri and writing letters to newspapers in Missouri and sending financial and moral support to activists organizing for change and justice in Missouri. The violence doesn't begin with the young man who throws a trash can through a window after the verdict is announced. The violence began years ago with the completely abusive and unjust and discriminatory social system in Ferguson. And to go after that, we're going to need disciplined, nonviolent action, and it's going to happen everywhere. There are people in cities across the United States and outside the United States preparing for demonstrations, nonviolent demonstrations and protests and action the evening of the announcement of the verdict. And I think that show of support and solidarity around the country and around the world, and very open and publicly declaring it to be nonviolent, constructive activism is the critical thing here. And I think we have to get away from the idea that we need to win over the police or the justice system in Ferguson, that they need to be defeated. What needs to be defeated is the mentality of injustice and the militarism.
All right, David Swanson, thank you so much for coming on today.
Anytime. Thank you.
That was David Swanson, an author, activist, journalist, and radio host, commenting on his op-ed, "Who Says Ferguson Can't End Well?" For KBOO News, this is Riley Turner.
A snowstorm that has dumped more than 5 feet of snow in towns near Buffalo, New York, may surpass snowfall records for a 24-hour period. The storm is expected to dump fresh lake-effect snow on the region already hammered by an Arctic storm system that has caused freezing temperatures across the Midwest as well. 2 to 3 feet of additional snow are expected in some places tonight. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has declared a disaster in the state and sent 150 National Guard troops to help dig out Western New Yorkers stuck in their homes or in their vehicles on the state's thruway. 5 people have reportedly died as a result of the storm, with the majority dying from heart attacks while shoveling snow. 1 death in Michigan and 1 in New Hampshire were also attributed to the storm.
Hundreds of residents of St. Tammany, Louisiana, packed a public hearing last week to voice their opposition to a drilling permit for the first fracking permit in their district. According to a spokesman for Louisiana Department of Natural Resources, it was the first public hearing for a drilling permit that anyone can remember. The department isn't used to opposition to drilling permits and rarely rejects such industry requests. But since April, when Hillis Oil and Gas announced plans to frack in St. Tammany Parish, public opposition has grown steadily in an effort to stop the company's operations before they start. St. Tammany is located about 45 miles outside of New Orleans. Attorney Lisa Jordan is leading the fight to stop fracking in St. Tammany Parish.
There are alternative sites for this project that would be more protective for the environment than this site, and specifically because this site requires drilling through a sole source drinking water aquifer. So we think because there is a better place and another place where they can go, that the department should deny the permit for that reason. Additionally, it should deny the application as it currently is because they have not minimized the risks to the environment. Again, mostly the risks to the aquifer. They have not minimized those risks. There's all kind of ways in which the aquifer could be contaminated, which they haven't sufficiently guarded against.
Can you explain what they should have done and what they haven't been doing in terms of what you mentioned to me before about the constitutional responsibility?
Thank you, yes. So all the agencies that permit environmental actions in the state including the Department of Natural Resources, have a duty under the Louisiana Constitution, Article 9, Section 1, is our natural resources article, and it says the natural resources of the state shall be protected and replenished as much as possible consistently with the public welfare. And in 1984, our Supreme Court interpreted that to mean that any state agency that was considering permitting an action that affects the environment has to basically do what amounts to an environmental impact analysis and has to evaluate whether there are alternative sites that offer more protection to the environment, has to evaluate whether there are, whether the potential and real adverse impacts of the project have been avoided to the maximum extent possible. These are things that the agency must do. The agency has never taken on this constitutional duty in the context of oil and gas drilling. And so we're here today to make sure that it does, or to try to get it to do that.
What are we looking at in the New Orleans area, not just St. Tammany, if this well is permitted and the drilling goes forward? What do you see happening?
Well, I do think this case has precedential value because this is probably the first place in Louisiana where they've attempted to frack a well where the population is significantly against it and where there is zoning that prohibits the activity. And so if they are allowed and it goes through the courts and the courts say it's okay to trump zoning, then that could, this could happen anywhere. It could happen in New Orleans, it could happen in any city in the state where basically your zoning means nothing. They can put an oil and gas well right next to whatever it is they want to. That's the issue that's going to be decided in the courts on this case.
Albita Springs Mayor Greg Lemons explained why he is opposed to fracking in his district.
I'm Greg Lemons. I'm the mayor of Albita Springs. What brings me here tonight is concerns about the drilling slash fracking that is proposed for our doorstep. We're literally 3.5 miles that way. Our town well is where we get the water for our entire citizens of Albita Springs. And I'm concerned that something could happen environmentally that would affect that water and really affect us as a community. We have no other source of water. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I don't see that there is a benefit to the town of Albita Springs about this whole proposition that's out there. There's not a whole bunch of revenue that we'll be getting. There's not a whole bunch of new businesses that we'll be getting, if any. And it's proven that these wells are only short-term, and there's very little investment that's going back to the state on these type of wells and that kind of stuff. So I'm here to kind of say my opinion, both from the environmental portion and both from the economic proportion of it. But it really, I represent the citizens of Albita Springs, and the overwhelming majority of the citizens do not want this enterprise at all in their area. You know, we live in the shadow of some very big paper mills from the 60s and 70s. We've lived with that air pollution and seen the smells and the river pollutions and that kind of stuff. So we're very aware of problems that could be happening from this.
The two lawsuits were filed by St. Tammany Parish government to block the project pending in state court and against the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources filed by the city of Albita Springs. The lawsuits will most likely not stop the agency from issuing a verdict on the fracking permit in 30 days. Thanks to the DSmog blog for this audio from St. Tammany, Louisiana.
Auto safety regulators have called for the recall of millions of vehicles with defective airbags made by Japan's Takata Corporation. Regulators with the National Highway Transit Safety Administration reportedly demanded Takata recall additional airbags after a safety incident occurred outside the area of the initial recall. However, the company reportedly declined to initiate a national recall. Takata has been at the center of a series of recalls over 2 years, affecting nearly 10 million vehicles. The new recall would include driver-side airbags installed before 2008 in cars produced by 10 different automakers. 6 deaths are suspected to be the result of the faulty airbags, which carry the risk of exploding at random and spraying passengers with metal shrapnel. A Senate hearing is scheduled for tomorrow, when representatives from Takata will testify.
The Spanish Navy detained the Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise yesterday. Members of Greenpeace were protesting oil drilling and exploration by the Spanish company Repsol off the coast of the Canary Islands. The Spanish Navy claims that Greenpeace activists on inflatable boats crossed into what is called an exclusion zone surrounding the oil company's ship. The Navy responded by using their own rigid-hulled boats to ram the activists' inflatable boats. One activist had her leg broken and was thrown into the water during the ramming. Last week, over 200,000 people in the Canary Islands protested the Spanish oil company's plans to drill for oil off their coast. Greenpeace's Arctic Sunrise is the same ship that was detained by Russian authorities for 9 months after activists attempted to board a Russian oil rig.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Richardson, Riley Turner, Joanna Peterson, Eric Tekadoff, Galen Sanford, and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111, and Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving guest hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with guest Stephen Hanks talking about his new venture, a walking tour in downtown Portland showcasing Portland's early African-American citizens. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fagering interviews Gideon Levy, controversial writer for the Israeli newspaper.